Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 709, March 2024.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell. In this episode, we're going to talk about a recent film release. I know. But we're going to do it. We had to do it because it's Dune Part 2. And we did Dune Part 1. And then we all went and saw Dune Part 2. And we wanted to talk about it. So we're going to talk about it today. Let me introduce my panel. These wonderful people who also went out to a movie theater and watched Dune Part 2. They are Gene McDonald. Gene, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. I think I'm from Team Dune 1, and I have thoughts.
You took a little podcast sabbatical, too, and you're back with us, so it's nice to have you. Nice to hear your voice.
Thanks.
Brian Warren is here. He's back from the Back to the Future podcast, and now is out in the sands, the desert waste. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, you know, I like the dry air. The dry air of the desert near Hill Valley, and the dry air
that's
here
right.
on the planet Arrakis.
Out there in the Utah part of Hill Valley is basically Arrakis at that point. Sure. Guy English hasn't been on for a while, but he's here now. Hi, Guy.
My name is a killing word.
Yeah. Guy is the show killer. Movie,
but yeah. Oh, ouch. Yeah, oh, wow. I haven't been on in a while.
Well, you put your hand in the box. These things happen, Guy.
I did put my hand in the box, oh pain. Yeah, that's true.
And Kelly Gamont is here. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Jason. In the shadows of the incomparable lie many secrets.
I like it. So, yeah, they brought Dune back, everybody. It came
did
back.
Did they ever? There's another... a lot of Dunes in this. A lot.
Holy moly, so many.
There is. Yes. There's a lot of, so many Dunes.
Several.
I want to start with a little trivia that I didn't realize until I was reading about Dune Part 2 and that little trivia came out, which is for Gene, who was my compatriot on that first Dune episode, 589, from November of 21. Gene, did you know that Frank Herbert was inspired to write Dune by being at the Oregon coast and seeing the sand dunes in Florence, Oregon?
What?
I've never heard that. I thought he watched Lawrence of Arabia.
Apparently he was writing a story that he never wrote. He was a journalist, but apparently could do research for things he didn't write. I don't understand that part of the story, but that's part of the story. And about like an ecologist who was trying to do restoration of native plants on the dunes in Florence, Oregon. And I've been to those dunes. They're awesome. In fact, there's that scene where Paul has the vision of the ocean from the sand dunes. And I'm like, it's basically Florence, Oregon
I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But we're not, this is a lot of sand in this one. Although we do get a visit to a black and white planet at one point, which I think the implication is like the sun is black and white there, makes everything black and white. I don't know. I don't care.
I think it's supposed to be kicking out UV.
It's cool. Like it's, yeah.
And all their fireworks are underwater. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Those were just cool.
It's all fine. And this completes the story of the first book, the original novel Dune, which Denis Villeneuve, excellent director, who really makes those spaceships that are floating quietly over the land look great. Still got it. He's back for the second part that he decided that it needed to be split in two. And I don't disagree. So this is when we last left. Maybe I'll do it this way. Previously on Dune.
Yeah.
When we last left, Paul and his mother had fled into the desert because the evil Harkonnens, conspiring with the Emperor, who turns out is Christopher Walken, they attacked and killed pretty much everybody in House Atreides, including Paul's father and most but not quite all of his pals, but Paul and Jessica flee into the desert where they find the Fremen, the indigenous population of Arrakis, and they are led by in a hilarious role, actually. I mean, you don't think Dune's going to be funny, but I'm telling you, Javier Bardem got a lot of great laugh lines in this. Like, there's some
really
wry humor coming from very serious Stilgar, leader of the Fremen.
Stilgar's not a funny guy in the books and in any other adaptation, but this one, for some reason, it works perfectly. He manages to frame the moment.
I know exactly what the reason is, and that reason is
Javier Bardem. Yeah. So he's like, hey, Paul, you know, prophecy going to be our savior. I'm a believer. This is the kid. He's going to do it. And then one guy, Jameis, played by, as turns out, I had forgotten this, but when I rewatched Dune, I was like, oh, it's Dr. M'Benga from Star Trek Strange New Worlds. He goes, no, I don't think he is the savior. I am going to stab him to death instead. And how does that work out for him? Not so good.
He's not really in the second movie. Let's put it that way.
I have a hard time liking Paul just because I like M'Benga so much that I'm like, oh, you took M'Benga away from me.
So this movie starts and it's like, it's Paul and Jessica and Stilgar and Chani and the Fremen and the wrapped up dead body of of Jameis, who is just there like, remember when we killed that guy? And that's where this one starts. So it's a pretty good line of demarcation, which is now it's into the desert with the Fremen, and how are they going to kind of like regroup, and how will Paul fulfill, or will Paul fulfill his destiny, whatever that destiny might be. And so we spend a lot of time in the desert with the Fremen, and then we come back to the desert and to the planet at the end, and there's this little chunk in the middle that is the Harkonnens on their planet, where basically Baron Harkonnen is frustrated that poor Dave Bautista is just not doing a good enough job, and he decides to give the job to his other nephew, played by Elvis, Austin Butler. Elvis of film, and he is a really messed up dude, and he is going to be dispatched to Arrakis. So we get that in the middle, but you know, most of the movie is Arrakis, and it's about Paul's journey and his mother's journey, and Paul's building relationship with Chani, played by Zendaya, but also this the core struggle of this, right, which is prophecies. Do we like prophecies? And if you're in them,
no.
I think you do not like them. I think that's one of the key messages in this movie is like, it's a, oh, Paul, it's a plan. And there's some jostling of like, no, it's a prophecy from the Fremen. No, it's a plan from the Bene Gesserit. It's all a scheme by the, and Paul's like, I don't want to do this, but he does it. It's just, I don't know. I'm leaping ahead, but that seems to be like the core of the movie is really like, if you're thinking of it, it's like Paul is supposedly the promised one, and the movie and the book, I think, are pretty happy to be like,
yeah.
Is that good?
He doesn't really have a lot of agency. I know we see him making his decisions and choices each time, but they're kind of
but he kind of wants
predestined.
It though, right? I mean, I think that's
that
conflict to me is the thing that makes this movie so fascinating, is that it's about somebody being told you are the promised one and being like, I can see what that is going to do and I don't like it, and trying to fight it, and then ultimately having to embrace it, which is like, what? Whoa. Just, it kind of blew my mind, that whole
idea. Like after the destruction of Siege Tabor, he just goes all in on it, right? Like he travels down to the south and starts marshaling the fundamentalists. It goes south. I mean, things go very poorly for, you know, the universe. And the thing that he knows about it is like, you know, he's responsible for, I don't know, billions dead. I forget how many billions he said, but once you're above one person dead, you're a bad guy. Billions is definitely bad guy territory.
That's very bad.
And yet
guy.
He finds himself trapped because, like, after Siege Tabor is destroyed, I believe he thinks that all of the Fremen will be wiped out, and he can't have that. So his hands are sort of tied in terms of fighting back. And as soon as he does that, you know, galactic war, basically.
Yeah. It sort of felt like he just kind of decided he was going to put a hand on the tiller, so to speak, and lean into it his own self. I feel like I've been on podcasts with all of you where we go to planets that are full of sand and nobody likes it and we've got a chosen one. I don't know. It sounds like something I've seen before.
Sound vaguely familiar.
So, but I think part of it was just sort of him deciding that he was going to be a little more active participant in it. But watching him struggle with that, like you said, Jason, was the part that I also thought was interesting, was watching him decide he wasn't going to resist anymore and was going to and stop going, oh, it's not about me. It's not about me. It's not about me. And going, well, what if it is? And, you know, if everybody's going to think this anyway, then maybe I can try and do something on my own, on my terms and not just let all these other people steer the rest of my life for me. Because maybe if I'm a little more, if I take a little bit more charge and kind of be the boss of this a little bit more, it's still not a lot of agency. I agree with you guys. He doesn't really get a whole lot of room, you know.
I mean, he's in a double bind, as Stilgar says, like, oh, he must be the one because he doesn't think he's the one.
Because he doesn't think he's the one.
Catch 22.
But, like, yeah. What's his main motivation here? Like, it's not to be the Messiah. He kind of wants to get back for...
revenge?
He wants to get revenge on the Harkonnens and mm-hmm. the Emperor for killing his entire family. And so the Messiah stuff it feels like he's trying to use it as much as he can to exact that revenge. And then at mm-hmm. some point he doesn't really have much of a choice because he gets back in the corner. He's like, well, I guess I really am going to lean into this thing. But I do kind of wonder like how much he really cares.
It's convenient. They're all one big target, right? They're kind of all the same target. So it works for him to lean into that.
Yeah, he is. It's interesting though. Like his dad's plan all along. Oscar Isaac, not in this movie because he died. Not Oscar Isaac. Duke Leto died in
that
in
escalated
movie
quickly.
Oscar Isaac's fine, everybody. He's fine. His whole plan was like desert power, Paul. Desert power. So even him being like the Fremen, we're going to use them, but it's like also it's their rising up, and I'm going to let them have kind of freedom that they didn't have before, and we're going to work with them and not against them. You know, you could argue, especially as he falls in love with Chani, that you could argue that he's also motivated by the Fremen. But I think mm-hmm. you could also argue that he's just using them like his father planned in order to get the forces he needs to do, you know, to make the moves he needs to do to win the war. And that's, I think fascinating because I don't think there's an answer, by the way. Like, does he have agency? On one level, he is a figure of prophecy, so he has no agency. On another level, I think that by the time he gets to the point of making the decision to act, he has come all the way around to, I am going to act. So he has to, like as Stilgar says, he has to make the choice. He's resisting, and at some point he has to embrace it. And so in that moment, does he have agency? Because he still has to be the one to embrace it. I don't know. It's all the I love the contradictions in this movie because I feel like you can argue all the sides of it. And I think you've got evidence on your side for that. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind the movie where he just settles into Fremen life. Obviously, that isn't this movie. The middle part is a little bit, but I don't know.
And
he makes
a
pretty decent Fremen.
He's out there for years. In the book, he's out there for like 5 years or something. At least it's several years that he's
minimum
out there.
Two, I think it's around there. But
two, 3 years. Yeah. His mom has the baby, which in this they speed it up. And I think I don't care about like book to screen to book. I know some people think the original book text is so holy that they want to worry about the adaptation of it. It's like I actually kind of don't care. I think that this is coherent in a way that is miraculous. So I'm like I'm gonna go with it. But
there's a whole lot like that can be a really tough road to hoe, especially something like this that so many people have read and loved, having it be coherent even though you split it into two giant parts and still end up with a coherent story at the end of it. I was really impressed overall.
Yeah, Yeah, no, this is weird stuff. And they drop some stuff out, or at least it's only mentioned in passing, like our friend Joe Rosensteel mentioned that there's this question, and Guy and I were talking about it, of like, did they even mention the reason that the spice is valuable is because of the navigation in the galaxy? And it's like, in both movies, it's mentioned in passing. It's like, it's there if you see it, but it's not made a huge subplot as it is in the books. And that's Denis Villeneuve saying, like, guys, it's a 160-minute long movie. There's only so much I can do here. But yeah. But he gets to the core of it.
He dropped a lot of the ecology stuff too. Yeah. In the books, they are those cisterns that they have where they're collecting the water that is to be used to one day eventually not reforest, rejuvenate the Arrakis.
They say that. Yeah. They do say it. I mean, I haven't read the book, and
you did?
I decided book one, I mean, after part one, not to bother, not to read it, because I really enjoyed part one, and I thought, I just want to go into part two with kind of the same frame of mind, which is, I don't really know all of the detail. I definitely don't know the details, but, you know, and I remember that about the water. Also, the spice, I understood that there is a, you know, the spice is what runs this universe, which otherwise doesn't have technology in it. Like, so that, right. I don't know. Somehow it was.
And it's being exploited by the galaxy, essentially, and the indigenous people are not benefiting from it at all, which is interesting. But
Need to read a specific book about that.
Yeah, there is more ecology, because that was the, I mean, okay, so there's the character who also dies in the first one, Kynes, who is the imperial ecologist, mm-hmm. who's been told basically, like, don't help. He's like instructed by, because the emperor is in on this plot to destroy the Atreides. That character was, in that same article that I read about Florence, Oregon, was originally the protagonist of whatever book Frank Herbert originally thought he was writing. He thought he was writing a book about an ecologist on a desert planet. And then it didn't end up that way. And that character is sort of like this little vestige of a way that the story was originally conceived and then was reconceived. But like underneath it all, there is this vision of the water planet and the idea, again, mentioned in dialogue, but it's, you blink and you miss it, that the water is being protected by the sandworms. The sandworms basically lock the water out because it's poison to them. Because as we see, if you drown a sandworm and extract its blue goo, you can see the past or commune with your ancestors or things like that. So that's all going on.
That is
on.
the best giant worm battle I've seen since Star Trek III.
Those Genesis planet
worm. The Genesis planet worm. Yeah,
should have been a no worms were harmed in the making of this film, because I was very uncomfortable.
No sandworms were killed. No Shai Hulud were killed during the making of this film.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
So Paul is at the center. I think it's a good performance by Timothée Chalamet. I think it's slippery, but like purposefully slippery. And I know I keep saying this, but like, I think my favorite thing about it is that it is about somebody on one hand being fated to something and kind of like coming into it, but also sort of believing that at any point, you know, you could not be the chosen one and you could die or whatever. But you're going to make the choices that you're going to make. And I know that, in the book, Frank Herbert got very upset at the reception to the book, because a lot of people really did view Paul as a hero. And I think that Denis Villeneuve, very clearly understands that it's as much a tragedy as a triumph when he steps into the part, because he is stepping. I mean, okay, Kelly, I'm going to do it here. It is a little bit that he becomes Darth Vader. yeah. I mean, it is a little bit that.
But if I knowingly turn into Darth Vader, then I don't have to go the full Vader, right? Like, I feel like that's
what
where
Darth
he's
Vader
trying to go.
Yeah, you know? I'll commit the crimes, but I mean, not in a bad
but
way.
I won't mean it, and I won't be happy about it afterwards.
Yes, I'll feel bad.
I'll do it, but I'll feel bad. And that's just the half Vader. Right.
I know, but that is so. It's on seen on one level. This film is the great final coming of age and ascent of Paul to everything that he's been fated to. Hooray! The Fremen have won the day. The Emperor has been defeated. Yay! And
yeah, like a really nice, big, clean top line. You know, like the headline is like. You
except
know.
On every underneath that line is everything else, which is that it's a tragedy. Because he's become the person who is going to cause a galactic war that will kill all these people. Now, I think there's, again, because I think that there's all these counter arguments, right? The counter argument is that if he doesn't do this, all the Fremen get wiped out. his whole family's been wiped out. Like, there are no good outcomes here. But he does choose an outcome and make it happen that he knows is going to cause a galactic war and billions or trillions of people are going to die.
I think one of the great things that we see at the end of this movie that's not in the book is Johnny just calls an Uber from his victory party and just takes off.
Yeah, she's like, Uber.
I'm done with you. You know, like, this sucks.
Yes. Her Huff arrived and she left in it. And that was that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, because that really underscores it. Like, no, Paul screwed up here. He did not. Yeah. Minimum, he didn't get the girl, which is, you know, kind of the way that. This,
right. He didn't. Not that girl.
Well, he got a girl.
He got the other one.
Yeah.
I mean, sure.
Yeah.
Not that I'm going to turn
marriage
my nose up and marrying like Florence Pugh or anything.
Right?
Loveless marriage for political reasons. Woo!
Yeah. Although she's actually kind of the soul of this movie. She's kind of on the ball.
Yeah.
Like, I actually kind of trust her. A, her insight is
Florence Pugh as Princess Irulan.
Florence Pugh as Princess Irulan. Yeah. She knows what's up. She's not super happy with the Bene Gesserit. She's not super happy with her dad, or at least she's advising him to, like, hey, don't go whole ham on this because you're just going to make it. You're going to exasperate the situation if you poke the bear.
And a trivia is Florence Pugh and Timothy Chalamet, they got married in Little Women. And I was like, he's going to marry her again.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool. Yeah.
This won't be for love this time, though.
Yeah, absolutely not.
We should say, we've kind of skipped over it. Yeah. The casting in this movie is phenomenal. It is, it is bananas good.
Spectacular.
And I'm going to call them kids because I'm getting up there. But like, I don't know how they're like 20 something. Who knows? I don't know. But what a gang of like the crop of the next level upcoming actors. Like every single one of these people is amazing.
They're all in their late 20s. Florence Pugh, Austin Butler's 32, Chalamet and Zendaya are both in their late 20s. Yeah.
It is so power packed, and you know you're firing on all your casting cylinders when you can put Anya Taylor-Joy in your movie for like 3 seconds.
3 seconds.
And it's still amazing.
Yeah.
Well, as a future baby. We could talk about that. But yeah, this is, I mean, it's when they said they're going to make a Dune movie, I'm like, oh boy, do we really? This will be the third adaptation in my lifetime of Dune, right? Because there was the sci-fi miniseries and the David Lynch movie. And I'm like, do we need to do this again? And then it was like, well, but it's the director of Arrival. I'm like, okay, I guess we'll do it. All right. And then the advantage is, it's first class all the way, right? Like the script is really well done. It's beautifully directed, of course, because it's Denis Villeneuve. But, on top of all that, the casting, like he got who knows, but it sure feels like he got everybody that he wanted, right? Like,
I don't know who the first phone call would be if these people were you know, like, well, the first person passed, so we had to settle for this person instead. I don't even, I cannot imagine that list. It feels like this was everything.
It is possible Pedro Pascal was offered something because he's in everything, but he's too busy because he's in everything. Yeah. So he's no, get, you know.
Maybe Tom Holland. Pedro Pascal.
Sure.
That's a fun draft for you.
Oh, man.
For some time. Recasting. Movies.
Was I the only one who was especially pleased that Christopher Walken was in this movie?
Oh, yeah.
I just was stunned. Wait, so that's a question I have. Did you know that? Because I didn't read anything trying not to be spoiled, and I realized I never had any clue who was going to be cast in Dune 2.
I didn't either, I had no idea, but then he showed up on the screen, and the first thing that pops into my mind, because hello and welcome to the inside of my brain, you will not enjoy your stay. The first thing that pops into my brain is, oh my God, they got the guy from Weapon of Choice, where the one lyric in, like, one of the two lyrics in the song is walk without rhythm and you won't attract the worm. And they got that guy to be in this movie. And it just delighted me. And I'm probably like the only person who made that association. And I'm comfortable in this particular part of the world, population me. But it just was really entertaining. On top of the fact that, you know, he's one of the many spectacular performances in this movie. And the thing I liked most about his character, I think, was like, basically, like, I know we didn't run him through, but he got in the middle of this movie. And so, you know, you can feel good about that, right? The bad guy got, but that doesn't mean the guy that got him is the good guy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, yeah. Stellan Skarsgård as Baron Harkonnen is the obvious baddie.
Yeah.
Right. He's the baddie. He's real bad. Right. And in the first movie, he is the baddie, but the Emperor is off screen. And one of the things that's interesting is, oh, it's Christopher Walken. And like, he's playing a much more kind of like approachable character in a way than Stellan Skarsgård is, because he's like a monster. But what's interesting is that Christopher Walken as the Emperor, he's the guy who has the leash of the monster. He is much worse. much worse.
Packaging.
He has a like a political violence. You know what I mean? Like he wields political power in such an underhanded way that, yeah, the Harkonnens are doing his dirty work. The thing is, though, speaking of political power, it's made pretty clear that the Bene Gesserit are also yanking around the Emperor.
Yeah, so I feel like they've got his leash.
Turducken of bad guys, which is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because Charlotte, like, well,
turducken of evil.
That's one of the reasons I think that simplifying and getting like the Spacers Guild out of it was a good move on Denis Villeneuve's part. Is like, there are so many different conflicting sort of political power structures, but I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, Charlotte Rampling, especially as the mother, but we've got there are a couple other characters in there. Talk about the Harkonnens. One of the things that's fascinating about them is that if you simplify the plot is the Atreides are too popular. People like them. And the Emperor is like, that's not good, because I want them, I can't do a Christopher Walken impression, but just imagine him saying it. That's not good. I want them to like me, not Oscar Isaac. Right. And so he says, but good news. I got the Harkonnens. Nobody likes them, and they are my weapon, and they will destroy the Atreides for me.
And his weapon of choice,
and that will solve the problem. And so that's Christopher Walken's whole thing. But the Bene Gesserit are in this too, and they are like
up to their eyeballs.
Because their whole idea in this movie is that they have conducted a breeding program, and like royalty and royal houses and things are themselves a breeding program, right? So that's going on, the political breeding program, and there's a whole second secret program going on surreptitiously that is trying to create this messiah. And they're like playing the game within the game. It's really interesting, to the point where they're playing the game during this movie, where they send the one sister to Fedrotha, the psychopathic cousin who's going to be put in charge of Arrakis, and she goes to him. We don't see it, but she comes back and she's like pregnant with his baby, so we got a fallback. It's like, dang.
A girl like you wanted.
Dang. Yeah.
Which was the part that just put the hairs up on the back of my neck.
Yeah. I think they mentioned that in the first movie, that Paul was meant to be a woman.
A girl. His mother was defiant and, you know,
they're mad at her.
She loved Leto, and that's kind of the thing. These people are not meant to be actually in love with their...
Yeah, but it was Oscar Isaac.
I don't know
what
to call them.
Yeah, I mean, you get it, right? It's Oscar Isaac.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Oscar Isaac's baby.
Yeah.
I mean, look, that's a long line, and it forms to the left, and it's behind me. Sorry, guy.
Sorry, yeah. I don't think I'm his type, so yeah.
Yeah, so there's the complexity of it, but also just the general sense that you get, which is there are a lot of people who are doing a lot of plotting, And they're doing a lot of stuff that is unpleasant because they're all plotting for power. And that is an interesting contrast to Paul, right? Because Paul, I mean, he sort of stepped into all the plots, I guess. But again, is he an actor or is he a passive person going along for the ride? Is he a disruptive figure or is he doing exactly what they want? Like, he's not doing what the Emperor wants. If he's truly the promised person, then he is doing what the Bene Gesserit wants. But is he
No, I don't think so. So they say, like, when what's her name? Fenring, I believe, is the name of the woman who became impregnated with Elvis's baby.
Yeah, Lady Margot.
Thank you, Lady Margot. She comes back. She's like, "Kate,
got a baby.
You know, got a baby. Baby on board
from the crazy guy. Yep, from the psychopath." Yeah,
they say that. It's actually early on, talking to the Emperor, talking to Christopher Walken. She says, "Yeah, but Fade is bananas. He's a sociopath."
Yeah,
and I guess it's Charlotte Rampling, and Charlotte Rampling's like, "Yeah, but he's controllable. We can control him to his desires."
That's so we cold,
don't care.
Right?
We don't care that he's insane and like murdering people left and right.
It's fine. We've got his leash.
He's our pit bull, basically. Sorry, that's a bad name for pit bulls. I never get doing it.
Is that scary? Yeah. I couldn't decide whether I wanted to read that screen as how terrifying it is that they can control him or whether they're delusional that they can control him. But
I think they're delusional.
Both.
To be like, I think like a lot of things in this movie, all of the above.
You don't get to this point without believing that you were in your own superiority and ability to beat everyone who's against you.
Exactly. I think that's why Paul gets away from them. They're, like, Charlotte Rampling at the end is terrified when he walks into that room.
Yeah.
She's terrified of Leah, who I don't know if we talked.
We haven't talked about it yet. No.
I've seen it twice, but I can't remember if the name. I don't think the name is ever any mentioned. But anyway, Charlotte Rampling is terrified
daughter?
Of the.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like all the Bene Gesserit are terrified of the abomination that she's carrying.
Yeah.
I think Paul really just does escape. Like he does not do what the Bene Gesserit are wanting. He escapes their plans within plans. And everything goes south, and like the entire Imperium gets blown up. So I think it's the Bene Gesserit got too big for their britches and like kind of screwed it up right at the
end. You created this, you planned this super person, and you couldn't control them.
Exactly.
Whether it's Paul or whether it's his sister or whoever it might
be.
Yeah, and they spent so long in the making of it. I think they just, by the end, they ended up a little too high on their own supply.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, that is one of the classic parts of this story, right? Is that it is a desert rebellion of indigenous people on a far off planet away from the center of the galaxy that brings down the Empire. Star Wars precedes. Star Wars was inspired by Dune, not the other way around. Just to be clear. And they were both inspired by other stories as well. But like, in the end, it is that classic story. The details are where you start to go, but like that is the classic thing, is that they all are so high on their own supply. They are so focused on their own little games of power, and that the rise of Paul is almost like an aberration, or at least they created a powerful figure, but they can't control him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think like, Dune, Arrakis, is effectively, it's not quite, but it's Afghanistan, right? It's the place where empires go to die. Mm. Like the British got messed up in Afghanistan, the Soviets, you know, I don't need to get into modern history, but like it's not a great place in terms of like being able to exert your power in far off land. And Dune has that same kind of vibe where like, you know, the Emperor commits an entire legion of his best forces to the Endor moon, to Arrakis, and it just goes horribly wrong. It's that that overreach. Yeah.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
I couldn't stop looking at the sand and the when the sand was on the screen.
I've got good news for you, because there's a lot of it.
Yes, and also, you know, just the whole Fremen way of life.
Yeah,
you know, we haven't talked about that. Just was fun to watch.
We should.
It, mm-hmm. And yeah,
we get Chani in the first movie is literally the girl of Paul's dreams. One day you will meet Zendaya, and won't that be great? Because she's great. And then, I mean, he meets Zendaya in that last scene where she's like, "Ah, you seem nice. Too bad you're going to get stabbed to death by this guy." And then that doesn't happen. But in this movie, they go to the Siege. They learn about the culture a little bit. They bond, but also Chani's got her friends who are like, "I don't know about this. This seems like a media BS made to believe us something that, you know, make us believe something we don't." They're all very, it's very kind of
it's
modern.
It's a high school cafeteria table.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what he wants you to think, right? Like, okay, all right, fine. But they do have that, they do make that connection, and we learn about them, and he learns their ways, and he's like, "I really want to ride a sandworm." And they're like, "Okay, well," and you go through that process, which is just, it spends the time with it. He gets his names. He gets named for, he says, "What's the name of that mouse? We saw the mouse in the first movie too." And if you read the book, you're like, that's what his name's going to be. Muad'Dib, the little mouse. And so we get all, it's a great, like, this is a long movie, although it doesn't feel long, but there's a lot in it. And a lot of it is meet the Fremen, who we didn't really meet except for like occasional encounters before, and spend that time with Zendaya, and spend that time with Javier Bardem and the other characters out there. And meanwhile, Jessica is also kind of like learning, you know, she ends up going down a path where she ends up taking the water of life, where they drown a sandworm and suck the blue goo out of it and give it to her, and she dies, but then she doesn't die, and all of that is happening because that's like fascinatingly kind of inserting her in their religion as well. And in the first movie, having rewatched the first movie has a bunch of shots of her with like all the stuff drawn on her face and stuff,
right?
Like they're setting up like that is where she's going to go, and she goes in this. So I really enjoyed all the Fremen stuff. We should talk about it a little bit more. Anybody else have things that were highlights for them from this segment of the movie?
I remember when I first read this book forever ago, I don't know. I was doing anthropology at the time, and I gave it to my anthropology teacher, who was not interested at all. He did not care about sci-fi. He cared about, you know, important anthropology stuff, but I was young. And one of the reasons I did is because I found it so striking just how complete and consistent the Fremen culture is. It makes sense. It makes sense that they're dragging Jamis's body all the way back, despite it being, now got to get a body all the way there, because they want to rejoin his water, right? The way that they sort of... I'm trying to formulate my thought here, because unlike Na'vi and like Avatar, this is a planet with essentially stripped down to its bare bones. There's sand, there's worms, and there's the ecology around that. Like, it's very simplified. There's not like this giant mesh of life. There's basically
there's nothing
worms
left. It's some trees.
Effectively,
some,
are the only aliens, I
some
think.
Some mice.
We ever see? Yeah. Oh, I guess the alien mice are aliens,
well,
too.
I think, and this is kind of book stuff, but I've always kind of assumed that, first off, that the sandworms, I think in the books, that they like were put on Arrakis, I think, in order to generate. But again, it doesn't matter. And I always have assumed, too, that the Fremen are just humans who came to that, because they're humans,
a long time ago.
And settled it, and then only then recently has a modern empire kind of moved in and said, "Step aside, you. We're going to take this over now." But like, so what? Who knows if there's anything left of whatever the original Arrakis ecology was? There might be nothing except maybe some plants and some mice and stuff. That might be about it.
But to your point, the consistency of the culture, it was incredibly well communicated. It all made sense. Despite the fact that, you know, they're fighting giant worms in pools of water, which is a weird thing for you to be like, "Oh, that makes total sense."
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it did. It worked. So,
yeah,
great.
Absolutely.
Just an amazing job. Yeah.
I love that it wasn't just this monoculture where everybody kind of thinks and talks the same too.
Yeah.
Like the division between the fundamentalists and the, you know, the maybe the younger kids, or at least the people from the north and the south, like that extra dimension makes it feel so much more real. And like, these are human beings and they're going to grow up and everybody's going to have different opinions about things. That was lovely to me.
I read a, or maybe I watched a, an interview with Villeneuve, who is, he's a Montreal boy, like me. He, I think yeah. he was born in 79, sorry, 69 or something like that. So he grew up in Quebec in a sort of a mixed culture that I'm very familiar with, where there's, you know, there's English people, there's French people. He specifically was talking about the Quiet Revolution, which there was a very much intertwined church and state situation going on in Quebec, the Catholic Church and state. And during sort of the 70s, that got shaken out to a much more secular kind of thing. And he took his own understanding of his own culture and sort of that part of the world and that understanding that different generations are going to have different ideas, and there's going to be like, it is not a hive mind. Like, it's not, bear with me here. It's like all Klingons like war and all Ferengi like money. It's not that. It's, yeah. there's,
yeah.
there's stuff to, it's deeper. There's exactly like you were saying, Brian, a richness to the way that these, this culture is expressed that I think, it's very deft and maybe not something that's easily written unless you've sort of had a life experience like that.
Yeah, really effective.
I think what I liked about it was, like, I remember reading the books as a younger person. And what I remember about it as a person who grew up in a desert was reading those. And it felt like, even though I knew intellectually, like, this is another, you know, this was made up, it's science fiction, it's another planet, that's not a thing, you know, all those things, it still felt like I was reading the experience of someone who had been there and spent time in this place. And I can't quantify what it was, because it wasn't the level of detail, because people can go on and on forever and it's still, you know, to build worlds and still not have it feel like somebody actually spent time there and then came home and wrote a story about it. And to me, that was part of what made it really interesting to read, and also translated really well to the screen and made it interesting to watch, was the balance between, you know, we're going to show you every grain of sand so you know you're in the desert, and like, you know, we're going to make you understand the fundamental things in their way of life that are the countermeasures to the facts of their environment. And that kind of the pieces of that I thought were really, really interesting and really well done, because it's easy to go on and not tell people anything. And so both of them were really effective and efficient in the way that was communicated, which is part of why I was excited about the movies, because of the way the book did a good job about it.
Jason here, just letting you know that you're listening to the non-member edition of The Incomparable Mothership. There is a member edition. It doesn't have any of those inserted ads. It's got extra material before we get started. You can listen to us warm up and talk about what we're going to be discussing. There's usually something people don't get to in the actual episode. The moment we stop recording, they throw out some other piece of information. You get that too. Plus, it usually posts before the regular show posts, often weeks before. There's also access to our unedited bootleg. There's a bunch of bonus stuff. There's a Discord community. So many great reasons to become a member. Check it out. We would love to have you, and it helps keep the lights on. TheIncomparable.com/members. I hope to see you there. It's really dangerous. And I think Herbert, in his original, you know, novel, is as aware of it as, you know, as a white guy in the 60s could be of it. But like, and now it's in the 2020s, and Denis Villeneuve is making this movie. It is tricky, right? Because you could see the parallels. There was a Lawrence of Arabia parallel. You're talking about the people who live in the desert who are indigenous. You can make them to be, you know, Arabs essentially, and map a culture onto them, a nomadic culture, and map a religion and make it sort of like have frills of Islam. And you could do that. And I think the movie, the book, first off, and the movie are very aware of trying not to tell the story of the outsider, you know, it's the Dances with Wolves story, right? It's the outsider from the other culture who comes in and solves everything. And like, that is kind of what the story is, but I think the movie is, and the book are both well aware of it and aware of the pitfalls, and are trying very hard to say, no, 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 that's not what we're trying to say here. And one way you do that is by actually respecting who the Fremen are as people and trying right. to not say they're all, oh, well, they're the warlike desert dwellers, right? Like, it's a log line like the Klingons. Exactly right. You can't do that.
Yeah. They also, another thing I loved about them is all their tech, you know, if you call it yeah. tech, but it's not. But bringing Jamis's body back, I thought, well, they're just, you know, they want to squeeze a few drops of water.
No, oh, yeah. man. So visceral. Like, what a great visceral moment Lord. That is, where it's like, you know, we put yeah. them in the suction yeah. bag and all the water just gets pulled out of them and they're yeah. left with a husk.
I like yeah. it when they're taking water from the fallen Harkonnen soldiers from that we see at the beginning.
Yes. Yeah.
First of all, you know what? I just want to talk about that shot where they're using the anti-gravity belts and they're going up the cliff.
Ooh,
yeah. Like yeah.
The rats have called the worm and they start booking it for the, you know, for the high ground.
Climb.
And they're floating up. Oh, the way these things float is amazing. Like, everything looks so cool.
There is a moment, there is one shot, and you know what the shot is, that is maybe the most amazed I've ever been and surprised in a moment ever in a movie. And it's when one of the Harkonnen soldiers is running up the dune and he gets to the top and he keeps going. And my brain is like, what? What just happened? Because they've got their anti-gravity tech that they use.
Yeah.
I feel like if you put that on the outside of a, like if that was in, I'm going to forget the name of it, but if you put it on the outside of a spaceship, it would be, not be weird, right? Like we're scrambling around on top of the space
shuttle.
But it's
somebody with weight who suddenly doesn't have weight and it's unexpected.
Yeah.
And
it is beautiful and it's right at the beginning of the movie and I loved it.
Yeah. But talking about sucking the liquid out of everybody, not only is that super visceral, and also it gets to the point of like, hey, you people watching a movie on planet Earth, you don't understand. We have different standards here at Arrakis. This really matters to us. And I think that's really good. I also love the detail when they're taking the water from the Harkonnen soldiers. That
did you notice that one guy was still alive?
Yeah. But what they say is, their water is too polluted. We use it for our cooling systems. I thought that was amazing, right?
I loved it.
And I get it, right? They've got like microplastics in there and who knows what kind of weird hormones and stuff. And they're like,
I took it to be like combat drugs, you know, like whatever
it is.
To be like,
it's garbage. We can't put it in our sacred water, but we can use it for the air conditioner. I'm like, wow. Wow. Yeah.
Well, and that's one of those details that communicate so much about their lives and what they do and how they live, right? Like that one, like they've thought about this and they've realized like there's, you know, sort of levels and that kind of thing. And that was one of the parts that I really liked. The other thing I really liked about that scene where they climb up the side of the cliff is the silence. Like everything. One of the things that I paid particular attention to in this movie was the sound, because in watching the first Dune, we get to the point, the opening when they get to Arrakeen and you get the as they go across, you know, and you get that big loud noise, and that noise cracked the glue in the subwoofer at my house.
Oh no.
so like they did it again and I'm like, something's wrong. I don't know where, and tracked it down, and I had to go take my subwoofer in to get repaired, and it's fine. But
I paid particular
attention in this film. I mean, it'd been 15 years. They were when I took it in, they were surprised that I hadn't had it in for this exact thing already anyway. So I was less concerned. But still, when I went and saw this one, I saw it in the theater, so I wouldn't have that problem, and paid particular attention to how it sounded. And one of the things I really, really noticed was everything sounded interesting, but also the points where there was no sound at all, or you could hear, you know, grains of sand blowing across the desert, or you could hear one person's footsteps in a very, very quiet place, you know, some very, very small incidental sound. And that was one of the things that really, really stood out to me in watching it, was hearing it. I may have been paying more attention to that than most people for reasons but that's part of why it really stood out. Yeah.
I think in contrast to the fullness and richness of the Fremen is the Harkonnen, who are just bad guys through and through. They don't have enough hair to twirl a mustache. But
is that why everything was black there?
So let's talk about that. There is a segment in the movie that it's interesting. The movie does not cut back and forth between them. Instead, it gives us the one thing, which is the really messed up birthday party for Fid Rotha, which involves killing various people.
This is my least favorite part of the movie when he just starts murdering women for no. It's like, we get it, they're bad guys.
So the Black Sun, they shot this on infrared film, and it looks very strange, and they're all bald and angry, and it's a real Bread and Circuses kind of thing, where it's like for fun, we're gonna have our sociopathic nephew kill a bunch of people in front of an audience, and isn't that gonna be great? And then we also get the thing where Lady Margot comes and meets him afterward, and we get that scene where he kills the women for fun, but only some of them, and it's all part of his basically, I think the impression we get is like this is his sex game. Is bring in a bunch of women, kill some of them in front of the others and all of that. And then he's also killing, there's an Atreides guy from the first movie who puts up a good fight, but of course also dies.
He's Roger. He wasn't drugged, right? I believe. He wasn't drugged. Yeah. So in the books, the Atreides Mentat makes it so that he's not, basically it's another bit that got elided, but yeah, he's just not drugged.
Right. I'm with you guys.
He's Roger Young. He's the fight director for the movie. Sorry about that. That's nice. I was trying to get that out. Yeah.
It's a lot. Rather than doing a kind of cut back and forth between what's going on with the Harkonnens and the Empire, we get a lot of Arrakis, and then we get this big chunk in the middle where poor dumb Dave Bautista, well, he's not dumb. I mean, he's a wrestler. Who knows? I don't know. But like, he's the nephew who was in the first movie and is like, this Madib, he's stealing all our spice and blowing up all our stuff. You're fired. You know, you're dead, whatever. I'm going to put my maniac nephew in charge and he's going to go do that. And that's the, like, the plot element we get here. This is the part of the movie I didn't like either. I don't know whether we're supposed to. It's a break from the sand. I get it. But like, I don't find anything in it. It's all very unpleasant and violent. And it goes on. I think this is really my problem with it. It goes on a very long time.
That was my issue.
It's like 20. Like, I don't know how many minutes. It felt like 25 minutes of this. And it just felt very unpleasant in the middle of the movie. This is where I went to the bathroom in the movie, by the way. I was like, you know what?
I wish I'd known that wasn't.
I'm out of here.
So
but, now, this is your opportunity to say, but there's that 2 minutes right in the middle where mind-blowing things happen, Jason, and you just missed it because you were in the bathroom. But I don't think so.
No, it was interesting in the beginning because it was so different, because it was such a change, and seeing what that world was like and how they lived and, you know, killed people and all of that. Yeah, like for a minute
that's
it
how
was,
they lived.
Yeah, like hello, you know, hello and welcome, you will not enjoy your stay. No. Right. They have no 5-star reviews on Yelp, and it was like partly like you, Jason, like I got to the point where I was like, I get it, you've hung a big lantern on this, and I can tell because everything's just black and white now. And so you hung this big lantern on, the bad guys are bad. This is exactly how bad they are. You didn't need to detail for me all the ways that they are bad by doing all of these things at quite this scale. And I would have been fine with that.
There's a couple of things we need to establish here. A, Fide is definitely a bad guy, and I think they over-index on that. B, that he has passed the same test that basically tests that he's quote-unquote a human, according to the Bene Gesserit, that only previously Paul was the only male to actually be able to do it. So it establishes that their breeding program is having some degree of success, so that's important. And then we kind of need to set up that he's just an incredibly capable fighter, right? And so why he has to fight the guy that's amazing. And
But killing a bunch of people standing around didn't really add to his rep.
Specifically, stabbing those women really just did not work for me. Because I'm like, okay, we get it. And one of the things I will say that I sort of commend Villeneuve for changing from the book, and I believe the 84 one too. In the book, the Baron is coded at very bondage and there's a lot of weird homosexuality stuff going. Not that homosexuality is weird, is what I'm trying to say.
He was preying on children.
Codes it that way. He's pulling out like heart plugs from like young boys and stuff. Like,
yeah.
Like they're
they portrayed it weirdly. Yeah.
What Fade is doing to these women, the Baron has been doing to like young men effectively during the book and the movie.
Right.
So I guess, okay, we're not going to code bad guys as being homosexual anymore. I commend them for that. I don't think we needed quite that many people just getting stabbed.
Yeah, this wasn't... You know. Making this decision instead wasn't necessarily better.
It's a mild improvement, I guess, but it didn't fit.
I'm glad
with
you
me.
Changed it, but maybe there was a better way to change it, I guess. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I kind of missed, thank you for saying that, because I missed completely the part where they said that he'd passed the same test as Paul. Like, I don't remember hearing that in the movie at all. And now that you say that, I remember it in the book.
She tells him to put his hand in the box.
Yeah.
And the needle, then there's no getting out of that, as we know from the first movie. I'm just saying from my limited knowledge of how the whole thing works, but I got it right away. I was like, uh-oh. Yeah.
I think I just didn't remember that in the slaughter. So,
I think Villeneuve had work to do here, and I'm not entirely convinced that he did his best work in terms of telling us what we needed to know.
Maybe he got distracted by making Geddy Brim look so cool, because it was really cool looking in those outdoor shots.
It does look so cool. Yeah.
But a better story needed to be told there.
Yeah. I agree. He filmed that with the UV camera.
Yeah, or my UV or infrared, but it's like
infrared.
It's weird.
It's picking up, yeah.
And it's like hell. I mean, that is the point of it, right? Is like, this is a hell. These people, this is what their world is like and their rule is like, and it's all terrible. And it does look super cool and weird.
Those fireworks are crazy.
I think a contrast was the scene in the first movie where it's a rainy hell, you know?
Right.
Like this was like, you know, this planet is hell.
That's a different planet. That's a different planet.
Yes, I know.
Well, that's where the Atreides come from.
I don't mean that planet. I mean the Sadakar planet what's his name? Who's not in this movie because he got killed in the last one, but goes to...
That narrows it down.
Yeah.
One of those.
The Baron's like right-hand guy. He dies in the gas in the last movie.
Oh,
He goes there to like recruit the Emperor's, some troops from him. And I just remember all the water and blood, like, and it was just like pouring and depressing. Mm-hmm. But the other planet was also depressing and sunny. So that's all.
Yeah, didn't like that part. I don't know. I mean, I guess I understand that it needs to be there in a way, but like there's so much of it. And
I liked it at first. It looked awesome. Like I couldn't quantify what the deal was. I didn't know it was infrared cameras. I'm just like, it's different and it's weird. And I get that if you can get Austin Butler to do that, you want to just let him do it all the live long day. And I 100% understand it, but I could have done with a little less of it.
I know people know Austin Butler from Elvis, but I was first introduced to him as Thea's DJ boyfriend on Arrow.
Yes!
Of course. A running joke that, you know, the Biff gang have had for years now. It's just the DJ boyfriend because of him. And he was actually, it was a weird, dumb role, but he was fun in it. It was like, it was very compelling. And so years later to see him having had this level of success, and he's amazing at a thing I just don't want to see. So it's not to impinge his performance or anything.
I didn't even know it was him like for a good long while, like to several scenes. Like I just kept looking at, you know, what with no hair,
it's hard.
He's still so
but
dreamy.
Then the lips, I kept looking at the lips. I'm like, I know those lips from somewhere.
Yep.
So the last segment of the movie, we get Jessica and Paul separate. She's gotten her marching orders. Paul does not want to go to the South because he feels like that is going to commit him to this whole line. We get the twist where it turns out that Gurney Halleck is the one guy, Josh Brolin. It's like the one guy who worked for the Duke who didn't die. And so he says, hey, did your dad ever tell you where the nuclear bombs were?
yeah.
Interesting.
Did your dad tell you about, you know, the birds, the bees, the family atomics, the basics.
The atomics, your legacy, yeah. The jewels, the atomic bombs. We've got those.
That ring. Yeah.
So, check. So that gives him a little, he's got a bigger a stick to wield now. The Harkonnens do attack the siege. So everybody has to go, and it's like, again, is Paul forced into it? Everybody goes to the south. Paul goes to the south, and at this point, Paul's like, "All right, we're gonna go." Really cool images, by the way, of riding the sandworms through the storms on the equator, and you're like, "Did they get through?"
Cool.
And you're like, "I don't know." It's, and then they're on the other side, so there's a real dividing line there.
Pitched on the backs of the worms, it looks
on the
really
worms.
Cool.
Yeah,
it's just wild. And then that's where Paul does the thing that you're not allowed to do if you're a man, right? Which is drink the water of life. It's death for any man. Chani mixes her tears and wakes him up, and he's had a vision. He sees Anya Taylor-Joy as his sister, because her mother, it's a great moment earlier when the mother takes the water of life, and then they're like, "Oh no, we've made a horrible mistake. She's pregnant." It's like, yeah. So now she's got like a telepathic baby who is talking to Paul and talking to her mom. And Paul has a vision of her as an adult. And he has the vision.
She must have known that she was going to have the Yvonne. Like,
yeah. Oh yeah.
She knows all of the rules of the Bene Gesserit stuff.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what's going on.
It's like
there,
the boogeyman,
right?
Of Bene Gesserit. It's like, this is the, like, you don't use the word abomination, especially with that reaction on your face, unless you're like, this is a very, very bad thing. Right. So she knew she was going to do it, which is.
Yeah. This is absolutely all part of the plan. Paul does.
But whose plan was the part? I don't know if it was ever clear in the books that she decided to do that herself.
She doesn't care. Paul has his vision of being in Florence, Oregon, and looking out at the ocean. and we get the revelation, which I had totally forgotten. I guess it's in the book, but I guess, which is that his mom says, I'm the Baron's daughter. I know that now.
That was in the book. He realizes it way earlier, but yeah.
Yeah, I forgot. I totally forgot that. It's like, oh boy, well, that's not great, but okay. and they do their, and they do the thing. He's embraced by the Fremen as the Lisan al-Gaib, this legendary leader.
In a terrifying speech. Mm-hmm. Like, first of all, he's reading fortunes and getting it right, which is freaky enough.
And they want him to kill Stilgar, and he's like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
I'm not going to deprive myself.
I'm not
going to
play your games here. He's too funny.
Do you smash a knife before the battle? I think it was.
He's too funny.
Yeah.
Do you smash a knife?
He's a cut up.
He's too funny.
It's the Javier Bardem. Come on. He's There's no laughs in this planet. He's the only one.
Yeah.
He's a Bond villain.
It's a kind of a terrifying speech, right? Like, I know we are seeing him as the. He's certainly the good guy as opposed to the guys that we just saw stabbing people for no reason.
And this is his moment where he embraces this, right? Where he's like, all right, I'm going to do the thing now.
Yeah.
I feel like he's not necessarily the good guy. He's just the less bad guy.
Yeah. Well, I think that's it.
You know, the lesser of two barons, I guess.
This scene was not victorious for me. It was like, now you're marshalling a giant army of fanatics, then that's never going
to
go
I feel like the most effective thing, and I'm circling around this theme again because I'm trying to nail why I really like this. And I think it is that the movie is the shape of a story that we're very familiar with. And in the details, the movie's like, no.
Yeah.
Like,
I love that.
Like, I know you like these stories. No.
It's like subversive,
it's not, no.
Right?
Don't do it.
Because I think part of what makes that moment so interesting, like, to me, like, I wanted to not be in a theater so I could back it up and watch it again, because it's watching him after Chani fulfills a prophecy, the Tears of the Desert Spring, right? We heard her earlier say, like, you know, my name is Desert Spring because of a prophecy, and I don't like that. I like Chani, which, you know, I also thought was a really nice, moment between the two of them when she says, but actually this is my name, and he says, okay, then that's what I'll call you. And I'm like, I see what you did
and
there.
She calls him Usul rather than Mordir, which is his fighting name, whereas Usul is his family name.
His other response could have been, sucks to be part of a prophecy, doesn't it?
But then it really does not sit well with her, because she feels like she enabled him to go and do that in the cave and, like, you know, not cool.
Guess
and
I'm
then,
bailing
you know,
him out.
Yeah, yep. You know,
yeah,
like,
she slaps
like I
him
said
after
at the,
that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, she, yeah, like he comes slap. Back. Yeah, he comes back and then she slaps him and leaves. And it does not sit well with her at all, which is why, you know, you said she calls an Uber and she's like, yeah, my huff has arrived and I'm a leave in it, you know, and nopes out. And that, I think, is really interesting because you're watching two of the people we've spent the most time with in this movie. And what happens when they realize that they are part of the prophecy and what they have a part of a prophecy, right? And then like what they have to do with that information. And she does not like it. And she does not like contributing to his.
And and he's seen the future. Like she is his destiny. Sorry, yeah. I watched Back to the Future recently. She's his destiny, right?
She's
so, like,
his
even
destiny.
That,
yes.
Even,
is
yeah,
what you're saying?
Yeah. Even that, it can, you could say it sort of sours the whole thing. It's like, oh well, we're meant to be together, but is that not right? And then her being like, I'm out of here, right? I'm on a worm. I'm out of here. That's probably what they say, right? I'm on a worm. And like it's also the breaking of it. It's like, but wait a second, I thought we were fated to be together, and it's like, oh, actually. It's all in the details, right? It's all in the details. Yeah. It's not what you think it's going to be. It's going to be worse. That's
She tells him, you'll never lose me so long as you remain you, something along those lines.
Yeah, as long as you're you.
Previously, we've been told that for the Kwisatz Haderach to arise, Paul Atreides must die. And I think this is what happens. He takes the water of life. He dies.
Yeah.
He's no longer Paul Atreides. He's now Muad'Dib.
He's just like Buffy. Kwisatz
Haderach.
You know,
sure.
You're gonna die to fulfill the prophecy.
She and then died they twice.
Then they come back. Yeah, that's how that. Yeah, that's how that goes.
But I do think that's the rebirth thing. And then now he's no longer him, and that's why she's like,
he's
Muad'Dib.
He's the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah.
So we get to the last part of the movie, and this is because at the end, one of the moments that I really like is that Paul knows what he has to do at the end. But talking about Chani, he knows what he has to do at the end, but he like has a moment for her. Where he's trying to prepare her for the terrible thing he's about to do. And I like that because that's him saying, not saying he's not going to do it, but saying, my heart belongs to you. You need to know that because
I think he could have had a better.
Yeah.
Let's start a throuple conversation. Because like, I think he handles it incredibly poorly.
But, you know, he's trying in a very difficult moment. He's trying to get it across.
I mean, he hasn't been the Messiah all that long. I get he's going to make a few mistakes,
it's
right?
Dramatic.
You know.
Well, he's also a boy, right? He's, what, 20-something?
Yeah.
Sorry, I keep calling 20-year-olds boys. Like, he's and
he's
definitely had a weird
life.
He's
a very young person with minimal life experience. And I get that.
Definitely, clearly overwhelmed.
Social contact with young people.
With sand.
Common people. I mean, you know, like, let's be honest. It's not like he lived anything that anyone in that galaxy or this one or anyone would necessarily consider a regular normal life.
Yeah. And it totally shows. He's pretty awkward. I love the moment where he tries to mansplain sand walking to Chani. That may be one of my favorite parts.
I loved that. Yes.
He catches himself because she's looking at him like, you are an idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She should just let him get eaten by a worm. Okay, go for it.
I read a book. Look, I read a book about sand walking. Okay.
Yeah, my private tutor explained this to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My private tutor.
I mean, he says that like it was a person. It was just a hologram. He's very lonely. So they do. They attack the Emperor's forces at Arakina, at the city, and it's very exciting, and they take over, and they kill the Baron.
He walks after him, he says grandfather, and just stabs him in the neck.
Like, exactly.
It's Aaliyah in the books that typically kills him, but we don't have her, so
so you end up with this moment where he's revealed, it's a great moment, right, where it's revealed that it's Paul Atreides, he's still alive, he's Muad'Dib, he's done all of this, end game, right? And the move after he apologizes to Chani is, I'm going to marry the princess, and you're going to abdicate, and I'm going to be the emperor. That's how this is going to work. And you're like, okay, This is weird, but all right, I guess so. And she's like, don't kill my father and we'll do this instead. And he's like, but first, a duel to the death. Because of course, a knife fight to the death. It's Dune. Of course, there's a knife fight to the death where it's Paul against the previously introduced psychopath, his cousin, as it turns out.
DJ Assassin.
DJ Assassin, Fade Rotha. Yes, exactly right. And this is, for those who remember the classic David Lynch movie, this is Sting, and this is, I will kill him! He does not kill him. He is killed. He's dead. R.I.P. to Fade Rotha, played by Austin Butler, at which point...
An amazing fight, by the way, just the look of it, everything was great. Yep. I think Paul does like one spinny flip that's a little weird, but everything else just looks incredible.
The assault on the Arakeen is really great too. I mean, there's spectacular visuals. Yeah. Spectacular.
Yeah, those worms are great.
Like, I've seen Oppenheimer and I don't know.
Oppenheimer
think that
says, Paul, don't use the family atomics.
Please don't use the atomics. But man, what
I have questions about those
sandworms standing in attack. Oh my god, it's so like just a phalanx of sandworms coming. What a mind-bending
How is that organized?
They know how to ride the sandworms, right? Like,
I know they know how to ride them, but it seems like you can only ride one sandworm in a sector the way that they have to mount them. You've got to get on a top of a dune and
they start from way back.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was too cool for me to care about. We see them going across the we see them going south in a phalanx formation too, right. I believe.
Yeah.
Right? Oh,
yeah,
maybe that's just one. Yeah. But yeah.
They went south as a group too, like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But man, it's killer. I love just the notion of the starter car who are, we're led to believe, effectively equivalent to Fremen in terms of their fighting ability.
Yeah, they're the greatest fighters in the Empire. Yeah.
The crackerjack troops. Yeah. And then when the worms come, some of them break and some of them are still standing there with their sword up in front of this like 300 meter maw that's just going to eat them all. It's like, oh God, this is so, it's outclassed. It's the end. Yeah. There's no point in you and your little sword. So.
Don't bring a knife to a worm fight, dude.
So the emperor surrenders, and then there's an interesting moment, right, where it's sort of like Paul, the other great houses are in orbit, and they say they don't accept you being the emperor, and Paul says to the Fremen, what does he say? He says something very poetic.
Bring them to paradise.
Bring them to paradise.
Bring them to paradise.
Go kill those guys. And I thought, have the Fremen been secretly learning how to fly spaceships in the meantime?
I wondered that too.
Don't worry too much about
it. It's autopilot. Are there pilots on there and they're just going to hold them and make them fight? I don't want to think about it that much. It's fine. This is the beginning of the war. And this is when Chani's like, later, I got a worm to catch. And she's out of there. And that's how the movie ends, is not Paul's victory, right? It's Chani's rejection of him and leaving to go back out in the desert because it's not a happy ending. That's the whole
point. His failure. She got frozen in carbonite and now he's stuck without her now. We missed the bit where Gurney Halleck comes back and kills Batista.
Yeah.
Which is a pleasantly brief fight that is satisfying in it, you know. I really like Batista. He's got better acting chops than I think you would necessarily think about, you know? Yeah. And then one of my favorite parts that we sort of skipped over was when Paul just busts into the throne room with all of his fedakin around him, all of his fighters. And he's like, bring the prisoners and kill the Sardaukar. And I'm like, God damn it, that is...
right?
You're clearly... two things. A, I think you're clearly evil. B, these Sardaukar we're going to fight to the death anyway. It's the Emperor. It's not like...
Your one
job is to protect this guy, so they're going to fight.
Honestly, that moment where he goes in and reveals that it's Paul, is this Madib character who they've been fighting all along, and the ramifications of that the House Atreides is not over, and they didn't kill him, which was like the key part of the plan. Like, it's a huge moment, and Guy, you'll appreciate this because you've been making Star Trek references all the time. the thing it reminded me the most of was the moment where Ricardo Montalban takes off his wrap in the desert and reveals that it's Khan.
Yes.
It's the same kind of thing. It's like, oh, you're screwed now. Like, this has gotten much worse now because now you know who this guy is.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and not a good guy, by the way. I said that about the guy who's the hero of this movie. Mm, is he?
I don't know. Mm.
He's the less bad guy. I'm telling you, he's just the less bad guy.
The genetically manipulated Ubermensch, right?
Oh, God, you're right. Wow. Oh, my God. Paul is Khan and Darth Vader? What?
We've got Seti Eels. We've got Shia Ludes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you think about it, you realize how many sci-fi franchises lifted stuff from Dune, right?
Bottom line,
Star Trek and Star Wars and lots of other things totally
and
lifted
so
stuff from Dune.
Many
Dune,
other things.
Which is, by the way, and I've seen some people say that, and I felt it too, that some of the stuff in Dune reminds me a little bit of Foundation, the TV series on Apple TV+.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dune, the novel, is absolutely a direct response to Foundation. It's Herbert saying this Roman Empire story that Asimov is telling is not how it works, and then he tells Dune instead. So it's just fascinating to see all these things kind of wrapping back on themselves, where you're like, this reminds me of the movie, but it's like, yeah, but that movie itself is using the source material of this movie for its own material. It's like it all kind of comes back around. But
I love that. Yeah. I love a conversation in art, and I think that's kind of what we're getting at here, right?
It's
reference to other stuff, lifting stuff that works well. What's your little spin on it? I really loved it. I had not previously realized the juxtaposition between Foundation and Dune until you mentioned it. Because, Harry Seldon maths it out, basically, which is effectively prophecy, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think Herbert didn't agree with the sort of Asimovian notion that it was like a retelling of Gibbon, of the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, and thought that it was much, much messier than that. And so Dune is much messier as a result. But then we see all these things. I think bottom line, somebody can write an essay about this at some point down the road. I'm not assigning homework to you. I mean, somebody in school who's got a paper to write, they can please write an essay. A 4-page paper. I want it on my desk on Monday, and I want it to be how Denis Villeneuve made this movie, had to make this movie in a world where we all know about Star Wars and story types like Star Wars. Because I do think that's part of it, is that we've seen those kind of archetypes so many times that it allows him to do a little shorthand, but it also allows him to do some subversion of what we expect. And I think that's part of the power of it.
Yeah.
On my desk, Monday.
I love that you just can't stop handing out writing assignments.
It's just how it is.
It's like it's your job, basically.
Look, it's Incomparable. If you want to get a passing grade in Incomparable, you got to do the homework. It's just how it is.
Too many years as an editor.
See, now I just hear David Bowie in my head going, you remind me of the movie. What movie? The movie with the desert. What desert?
There's so much, but what have we not touched on that any of you would like to talk about? This is your chance before I start talking
frame
about
one,
the future.
It's black. Frame two, a little less black as we get some text. Basically, frame by frame, I could go through this movie and tell you why I love it. And
I gotta get another
time.
I gotta get another
I will
another
subscribe
beer,
to that podcast,
yeah,
guy.
Yeah.
I'll
yeah,
need another. I'll
you
need
may
more
need
water
to delete
of life.
Space on your hard drive.
The Dune
this one's
frame
going
by
log.
Frame podcast with Guy English.
Oh, you can just turn it into a Mastodon account. It'd actually be pretty good.
Yeah,
I will. I will happily listen to that podcast for real.
Jason, you mentioned it earlier. The scene where they're floating up is beautiful. I could not get enough of it. I would watch a whole movie like that. There's the silence, the audio effects that Kelly was talking about previously, the fluidity of the way they float and move. I loved it. One of my favorite scenes in the previous movie was when the Sardaukar are attacking the Siege and they just drift slowly down.
Right.
It's like Americans fast roping from like Huey's, right? But it's so much quieter and stealthier and it has a weird ethereal magic to it that he captured so incredibly well. I guess that's the final thing I'll say, because I don't want to go on too long, because I could. But I just want to re-score just how amazing those floating effects are. We see Sardaukar, Gurney Halleck alight on the ground after he's stopped playing the Balisset, and he jumps out of the spice miner and then slowly floats down. And God, it's just beautiful. I don't know how to describe the kinetics of it, but it's of a movie chock-a-block full of incredible effects, I think that's an unsung hero. There's, of course, the whole worm riding scene, which we elided, where Paul learns to surf in the sand. I love that. That was so kinetic and visceral. I saw an interview with Villeneuve who said that it was his favorite shot when we see the camera's just at his back and we see him sort of crouch down with his foot kind of close to the mid to left side of the frame, and he slowly manages to stand up as he gains his footing.
Yeah.
And the music swells and everything's
and the,
like, oh,
the
I'm
moment.
Like, yeah.
Yep.
You're like, you're doing it, Paul. This is awesome. It feels amazing.
Yeah.
And it's one of those moments where you're, at least, you're not so worried about him being a messianic, you know, maniac is going to end up killing millions of people. You're just like, great work, Paul. You get up on that worm.
Guy, are you saying that Point Break stole some ideas from Dune?
Look, we're all influenced by Dune. Like,
everyone did, Dune. I think.
It's just
Dune
all the way down.
Yeah. Worms all the way down.
Yeah. It's just, yeah, it's worms all the way down.
One thing that we haven't talked about is the soundtrack. Holy smokes. What a beautiful, beautiful score this is. And again, I thought Dune 1 was great. I'll say Dune 2 is even better. Like, I cannot stop listening to it. There's some incredible song or tracks on this one. The worm ride one in particular, really, really delightful. It's just, you just feel it and you just crank it up with your headphones on. You'll feel the movie all over again. Highly
crank it up on your speakers, but watch out, your subwoofer will blow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
it
good.
It didn't blow. It was just 15-year-old glue that finally gave up. Just like went full Chawny and just, you know, bailed on the entire
took a worm,
scene.
Got out of there. Yeah, Hans Zimmer, I thought the last one, he really outdid himself. I felt like he was writing, like there were Hans Zimmer parts in it, but that there were like, he, like four other composers also trying to get out. Like it was I was very impressed with that. And yeah, it continues with this one. The soundtrack is remarkable.
I think when you get a chance, certainly now, I think when you get a chance to work with Villeneuve, you bring your A game, right? You're like, okay, sure. I'm going to try new stuff that I'm not.
You have to. Yeah.
I don't know. Like if Hans Zimmer scored Home Alone 8, I don't think he would be putting in the attention that he put into this. And this is like a work of art from every department. Costuming, incredible.
Yeah.
Like, name a department, they nailed it in this one. It's incredibly good.
Yeah.
I think Zimmer doesn't make those kind of movies anymore.
I know. I think he's just mostly being a goof.
He's got like a pseudonym he uses for it, right?
Yeah, Home Alone 8. I haven't watched Home Alone 4
I don't,
through 7.
You know what? I went 8 because I'm like, maybe there's 4?
How many are there?
I picked a high number because I'm
choice,
like, I don't
choice.
Think
like
there's
it.
That
I like it. I like the way you think. Anything else that people want to mention?
I mean, I would have liked a little more Ornithopter, like flying, not seeing them fly, but watching them be in the cockpit of an Ornithopter. But I understand why that just, you know, this movie was telling a story where from the people who don't have a fleet of Ornithopters.
More worm travel.
But I don't know. I like aviation and I the Ornithopters was one of the most exciting things for me. Yep. Dune
sound they made
one.
In Dune 1 was so you could just feel
that
it.
Sound oh yeah
and also I got confused at some point I knew somebody was not dead that was coming back and somehow my brain just said it's gonna be Jason Momoa. I don't know how but
great.
He's gonna come back.
I don't want to say anything because everybody that's read the books
okay,
here
yeah I that. Understand yeah. I understand like you know I'm a person who watches movies in this era where we have things that have 21 movies already in them and people have to come back. But I didn't realize, you know, then I saw Josh Brolin and I said, oh, well, that makes more sense.
Because Goonies never say die, y'all.
What I would say is that the Jason Momoa character dies in the first movie. He dies in the first movie, but this is science fiction. And even in the books, there are ways of bringing back favorite characters in surprising ways and many characters come back in surprising ways and as those books go along but that's actually not a bad segue a little bit into the fact that Denis Villeneuve has said he's gonna make almost certainly at this point given how well the second movie did a Dune Part 3 or a Dune Messiah, which is the second book by Frank Herbert. Now how closely that will hew to the novel is hard to say since it seems even less filmable than Dune in that it's mostly like talking and politics and strategy. Oh, no. And my guess is that he has a plan. And I'm willing to go with it.
He sent Johnny away at the end, right? Which is a diversion from the book.
I think he's got some
thoughts. I think she's our protagonist, to be honest. I think that's what's going to happen.
And like I said, Herbert wrote Dune Messiah in part as a response to people thinking that it was more of a story of triumph than of the tragedy of Paul Atreides. And so he wanted to have Dune Messiah really kind of like hammer that home. And I think Denis Villeneuve is on it. And so, and he doesn't plan to make a Dune part 4. So I think that he's got sort of like, he knows where the story goes and it's found something to tell with these characters. And I'm here for it. I mean, if they didn't do it, I'd be fine with it. I think that this is a remarkable accomplishment to make these two movies based on this book and to do it so stylishly. But I think it's also cool that he feels like there's a little more story he could get to by adapting at least aspects of that second novel. So that's cool.
I give him time. Don't rush that, please. Just go away. Do other projects if you want. Don't screw this up because you're killing it. I suspect that whatever he adapts Messiah to be will be the conclusion. Like, it'll be the thesis, the end of his thesis of what he sees Dune as, right? Mm-hmm. Where he's going to need to diverge from the books in order to present his own sort of take on things. And I'm looking forward to it. I found this a satisfying conclusion to, like, if we just ended here, I'd be happy. I even feel like if we just ended with the last one, I'd be like, damn, that is an amazing movie. Is it a weird ending?
I was more happy with that ending. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't need to know more. I was so enthralled just by the whole movie. And this time I was, since I already knew the world and, you know, like I wasn't being quite as blown away as I was by the whole thing. I was like, well, that seemed like a cliffhanger. So I did not know. And I guess I'm not going to read the book for another 3 or 4 years.
We can read the first book now.
You read the first book.
I could, but I feel like I might just know too much. Mm. Like, and I'll have ideas about what it should look like and do. And I don't know.
Maybe.
Anyway.
Jason, I trust Denis Villeneuve, and I trust that he has a plan. But George Lucas had a plan, and Phantom Menace was all about trade negotiations. So
it's true. Well, he does have the book to guide him, and maybe he's decided that he can make a better movie than that. I don't know, but yes, I was going to make the Phantom Menace reference there too. It's like more.
Yeah,
I think we're good hands.
Negotiations.
Peter Jackson had a book to guide him too, called The Hobbit.
Yeah. I do think that, like, the trade negotiation stuff is Lucas going back to the Dune well and pulling things out that he pulled out some toys he was not ready to play with and kind of...
the goal
broke them.
Obviously, Villeneuve's goal is to show the cost of what Paul has done. And and the personal cost as well as the galactic cost. And I think that that's what will happen. But I'm also... That is supposed to be... like a decade after the events of this movie. So if he wants to take a little bit of time, although apparently there is a script in process, but he says he may not direct that next. He may direct something else. I think that would be okay. I think giving everybody a little bit of a break and then coming back and checking in with these characters in a little while might be good. Yeah. But again, I'm kind of boggled that we've reached this point because I didn't think that this was going to be much. Like, who wants to see a Dune movie? And it turns out lots of people. And they saw the sequel too. So I guess there will be another one, but they can take their time with it. I'm okay with that. I think that's just fine.
That was one of the things I marveled at, was like, in having read the book, not necessarily recently, but in having read it and feeling like what the kind of the high points were of the books were some of the things that I was seeing executed on film, and being able to see that and then seeing where the Harkonnens were, you know, with the infrared camera, like how all of that was different and how all of it was weird and interesting, and all of that was fascinating. And I remember sitting there and having a moment, probably while I was just sort of waiting to get back to Arrakis when we were still in Harkonnenville, and going, like, I can't believe that, like, you know, we've made it to the point where this is a thing that is filmable. And then watching them, you know, float up that cliffside was amazing. And getting to watch that and just sit there and just go, wow, which doesn't happen very often in a movie for me anymore. And just marveling at what I was getting to watch was pretty interesting. So, and I also, I think what I like about the ambiguity in this one is because the whole like destiny versus decision and, you know, how much of what I'm doing is actually me and how much of it is on a track. I mean, I personally, as everyone on The Incomparable knows, have a long and storied history of really enjoying that kind of story. There was a show called Westworld that people might be familiar with that kind of did the same thing. And you know, watching people struggle with that and other stuff that I know I've talked about across the network is also part of what gave this a lot of appeal. And then the way they portrayed it and getting to go on that journey with Paul as he does this and what his decision is, and getting to go with Chani as she goes through a similar process that sort of has less galactic consequences. Was really something that kind of, you know, like show me content created in a lab to make Kelly happy at the movie theater. Like, you know, that was very much it.
Any other final thoughts about Dune Part 2 before we close the book on it?
Well, John Syracuse did try to convince me in the last podcast that David Lynch was even better.
No, so no, Gene.
I haven't watched that yet either. David Lynch is better than Dune 1? Okay. No. Yeah, well, no, he's a fan. Yeah.
Me too. I am a giant fan of the 1984 one. I think that it's a weird, flawed movie, but I think it hit exactly the right time for me in terms of my age, where Lynch
that's
being
what
weird
I got the,
when I was like 14, 15, whenever it was.
I got
it.
That
like,
impression.
I know John's basically my age, so I'm not surprised that he has a real soft spot in his heart for it.
Well, now I can watch it because now I won't be spoiled.
That's true.
That's what I was excited about. That's all I'm saying.
Just wait till we see Sting.
I will kill him.
Oh, yeah.
And there's the Sci-Fi Channel. You can watch that too, maybe.
Which is also pretty decent.
Yeah. They all emphasize different things. It's actually kind of fascinating, right? That's a mid-budget kind of thing, but they were trying to do a more straight-up adaptation, whereas Lynch is doing David Lynch stuff, and they're all very different versions. They're all very different. It's fascinating of the same.
But I think that's kind of the thing we were talking about with the conversation of between art earlier, right? This is such a rich source material that you can adapt it sort of to express yourself in kind of a lot of ways, completely different ways. You can have a different take on it and use that, which I suppose is true for all art, but whatever. There's a consistency to this world. And, you know, I don't think Lucas stole from it so much as did that. It's like, okay, well, what's my weird interpretation of this kind of setup at times? I do commend the 1984 one. And I know, I think Jason Joe Rosenstiel was telling us that he liked both 84 and the sci-fi version.
He thinks that there are aspects of the adaptation of the novel that were he thought they made some different and in some cases better choices. I think is how I would summarize that, and I think that's fascinating. Like you said, Guy, it's actually very rare that you see multiple adaptations of the same source material over the course of decades, and this is a good example of that, and it's very complex source material, so they have to make their decisions about, you know, and Denis Villeneuve made his decisions and they're very different than David Lynch's decisions, which are very different than whoever was the motivating factor on the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries, you know, so they all
the only other one I can think of similar complexity and having different very different takes is Lord of the Rings. It's Peter Jackson's, and then there's the Ralph Bakshi.
Ralph Bakshi.
Very different takes.
A little bit different takes.
Yeah, but both fascinating. Well, I mean, Lord of the Rings is obviously, Peter Jackson's is obviously a huge hit and it's pretty much it, universally loved. The Bakshi one is weird, but I like it.
It's bizarre, but good.
All right. We've reached the end of our talk about Dune 2. Maybe we'll be back someday with talk about another Dune, a part 3 or a Dune Messiah or something like that. But until then, we're closing the book on the, we're raking the sand. We're digging, sending the worms back in the sand. I don't know what the metaphor here is. Here, let me thank my panelists and get out of here. I'll be on a worm shortly. Gene McDonald, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Warren, thank you.
My worm's waiting outside. I got to go.
I know. Got a worm. got to take it. Guy English, thank you.
Planet Arrakis is beautiful when the sun is low.
And Kelly Gamont, thank you.
Goonies never say die.
Nope, they do not. And thanks to everybody out there for listening to this episode. We will see you next time. It is prophesized.